Hello, and welcome to episode 21 of Destroy Before Listening, which is a conversation between myself, Pete Byrne, and Neil Turpin. This is the part one, which is focused on discussing the music that he was part of during the 90s. As an active drummer for the past few decades now, Neil has been involved in a lot of bands which evolved from the mid-90s lead six scene, groups like Polaris and Baby Harp Seal. The longest running of which he is probably best known for would be the band Bilge Pump. We also talk about the smaller projects like Diesel vs Steam and Solangi, who also provided the perfect fit for intro music to this show from the first episode. There is a part two of this conversation which brings everything up to date on the past 20 years of his musical career. Please rate, review, subscribe, and share to anyone who may be interested. If you want to support this podcast, there are some nice Destroy Before Listening slip mats for sale. See the show notes for a link. You can also follow on Instagram at Destroy Before Listening. Thanks. So your hometown is Preston. If you just want to give a bit of background about growing up and the area and stuff.
I was born in Chorley down the road, but grew up in Preston, and I was there for 19 years. What can I tell you? It's just like one of those typical sort of northern ex-industrial towns, really. Famous for its cotton mills in the past. It's a big seat of the Industrial Revolution. Okay, Horrocks' yeah. Cotton mills, like, it's where my grandparents worked. I hated it. And by the time I was a teenager, I just wanted to leave. And by the time that I did leave, I felt like it was more of an escape than just leaving. It was like, I just thought, I've got to get out of here. You know, it's just this burning urge to just like see what else was out there in the world. But, you know, I've mellowed over time and kind of like, I quite like going back now and again, see my mum and, you know, just sort of like get a little bit nostalgic. But I mean, at the time, it was just like, I don't know, it just seemed horrendous. I mean, in its favor, it had like a good record shop and Action Records.
And I guess I remember Action, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that was a lifeline, really. You know, just really, really cool, good independent record shop. And yeah, skateboard scene as well. So they were my two sort of points of reference for ways into this kind of alternative music scene and alternative life, I guess. So yeah, skateboarding and music.
Well, sorry, the two things are kind of hand in hand, although are for most people of that generation or time, I think.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, skateboard videos were a sort of like way to be exposed to like interesting music that you may not have heard before.
Oh yeah, big time, like the Santa Cruz videos of the kind of late 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Those Santa Cruz videos were sort of like really massive for me, like musically and also, you know, what the skating that was going down on them as well.
So that would be, I guess, where you heard the SST stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's where I heard it, like Minutemen, Black Flag, everything, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. All the SST soundtrack. It was like, yeah, mind blowing. You know, you're watching this great skateboarding and then listening to this amazing music. And, yeah. You know, it kind of like totally shook your world up if like me, you were listening to sort of Iron Maiden and Slayer and stuff, and then you hear the Minutemen and Black Flag and you're just like, whoa.
I was interested, so was there any point that you were into metal, or did you learn your drumming initially based around metal, or is that just a passing phase when you were much younger?
No, I was into metal. Yeah. I was into metal big time. I moved around a lot as a kid. Like, we managed to sort of move house like four or five times. I got into music like early. And I really like Adam and the Ants and a few things in the charts. And then we moved again and I moved school, and all the kids at the new school were into metal. I don't know, I was the new kid, and a certain amount of bullying went down. I remember sort of like being pinned to the floor by some kids, and they were just like, "What kind of music are you into?" And I'm like, "Adam and the Ants." And they're just like, "You're just like, that's shit. You should like metal. We're into Iron Maiden. We're into Black Sabbath, you know?"
Yeah.
So it was forced on me. I was bullied into it. But
I
actually really, really got into it. And, you know, that was like age 9 or 10.
Yeah.
So from that point, I was listening to, yeah, just your classics, your Sabbath, AC/DC, Iron Maiden, Dio, you know, that kind of stuff. So that became really huge for a few years. And yeah, and that was around the same time that I started playing drums as well. So it was something about listening to metal and this idea of bands as a thing, as a little gang or a group. There didn't seem to be any barrier to not doing it in my head anyway. When my mates were learning guitar at school, I just had the thought that, well, if I learn to play drums, then, you know, you've pretty much got a band. That was really my entry into it. It was like with a view to making a band, you know. I don't think there was anything particularly about the drums that drew me, apart from nobody else was playing the drums. The post was vacant, so I just thought, okay, I'll take it and we'll make a band. And that's really how it began.
I guess in your mid-teens or later teens, you got more involved in the idea of doing a band, you know, getting involved in whatever scene was happening around that kind of subculture that you were mentioning. This is like a more of a hardcore, I suppose. Would that be correct? Or
yeah, I got there gradually. You know, I did make a band with my mates at school before any of that was, you know, even on the radar. And we had a little sort of metal band. I just got like mid-teens. Yeah, you know, like you say, like discovered more interest in music via skate videos. And also listen to John Peel as well. And then, yeah, Action Records again comes into the picture because they were stocking like really interesting underground music and also zines as well. So via zines, we got the idea of like DIY as an attitude became apparent. And like, you know, the idea of putting on gigs and not needing anyone's permission to do it or any special knowledge or, you know, privilege. It was like, just became clear as an idea that like anyone could do it if you just wanted to do it. And you had like a group of you that were all sort of on the same page with it. It became a reality. And I guess as a result of that, I ended up going to a few small gigs. Like up to the point of about age 15, I'd only ever been to like big gigs, big metal gigs, Iron Maiden, Metallica, you know, big venues. And sometimes, you know, I talk my mum into taking me along because I was too young. So I've dragged my mum along to like Iron Maiden gigs and stuff like that, which is, you know, very cool of her to do that. Then I saw Snuff actually at the Caribbean Club in Preston in about 1988 and eight or nine. I think that was actually my first DIY gig, even though I wasn't necessarily calling it a DIY gig. It was just like John Peel announced the gig. You know, he just read out the Snuff tour dates and I just heard, oh, okay, they're playing Preston. Wow, that seems amazing, you know?
Yeah.
So we went along and it was like my first experience of a gig where, you know, it's just the back room of a pub and there's loads of flyers on the desk and zines. And it's like, oh, wow, this is amazing because it immediately gave you all this information for other stuff that's happening. And that was really how information got passed around, you know, pre-internet. It seemed like a really amazing sort of hands-on, you know, and just really like a strangely direct and exciting way to sort of find out what else was happening.
Well, I know you'd mentioned about it, like the zine thing. So did you personally like create a zine or kind of get involved on that level?
Yeah, that came like a few years later after I'd moved out of Preston. I did two issues of a zine called Little Spanner, and it was kind of its era in the fact that it was like a personal zine with like stories and thoughts and inner kind of inner sort of monologues. So yeah, that happened in Leeds like in the sort of mid-90s.
Right. I'm gonna like Sned mentioned something which I think that maybe relates to, and this is like Spoon Do Spanner Do. Right.
Oh god,
I don't know. Explain what's that. I don't know, has that got anything to do with spanners or
That was a game that we used to sort of like have these little reckless adventures in Leeds where we'd sort of like wander down the railway lines, you know, see what was there, and sort of there's a big viaduct. We'd walk over it, you know, and sort of chance it, hoping that a train wouldn't come and stuff. But stuff that you would just really be getting the shit for these days. But
yeah,
it seemed sort of like a little bit more naive and you know, it's kind of irresponsible, but like fun. It was seen as an adventure. But anyway,
were you either a spoon or a spanner?
On one of those little adventures, we found this massive spanner, basically, like a sort of like, you know, like a meter and a half long spanner that you had to carry with like two hands. And uh-huh. I guess it was used on the railways. For some
So
we found this massive spanner and decided to keep it. So we had this massive spanner. And I can't remember how the spoon bit came into it, but we lived in this shared house on Chestnut Avenue, and in the back alley, it led out onto a back alley, which was just like rough ground. So you could have bonfires out there. It was a bit of a free for all. Yeah. I mean, it's just this just evolved naturally just from like being idiots and drinking and having this massive spanner. But I can't remember what the first object which was destroyed. But the idea of the game was somebody touched something with the spoon, like a wooden spoon. Say like,
oh, this comes in late to something later on, but yeah, carry on. Yeah.
So maybe this mug. So maybe if I touch this mug with the spoon, whoever was holding the spanner would then have to come and just like destroy it with the spanner. it was just a kind of silly, fun, destructive game that we used to play in the back alley of the house.
Right. So that's spoon do, spanner do. Right. Good. Like it.
I'd not have thought of that for years. I'm glad you mentioned it.
There you go. Right. Well, back on to before the zine. Well, you get involved in gig promotion in Preston then, if you've got a band and you want to do stuff, and I presume zines wise you see Maximum Rock and Roll or
Maximum Rock and Roll was, you know, you could get it from Action Records, so yeah, I definitely picked up a few copies of that. I wasn't really like super into like the really sort of crazy hardcore shit. I was really into like Discord stuff and the more interesting indie rock stuff like Slint and Codeine and Mercury Rev and things at the time. But then, yeah, the Discord record stuff was really, really like massive for me as well, like really great in that era. I was doing a media studies course in Preston at college. Through that course, we had to do like a practical assignment. And I just thought, well, I'm going to put on a gig. I've been reading about how to do it in like Maximum Rock and Roll. And I just thought, fuck it, I'm going to put on a gig. Around the same time, I think it was either me or my mate Rob, one of us bought like a Lungfish album, Talking Songs for Walking.
Mm-hmm.
And inside it was like a kind of press release thing that gave, it said like, you know, they were sort of, there was an upcoming tour and it had the details for the booking agent. So we just rang him. We just rang this guy, this booking agent, and he, you know, he's in London. John Barry, he was called. And like, I was 18 at the time, and I just said, yeah, I want to put on a gig. Can we put Lungfish on? They were touring with Circus Lupus. So he's like, yeah, I want to put this gig on. Like, how much money do you need? And, you know, what kind of PA do you need? And then he was like game for it. But like before he really sort of gave us the go ahead, he rang my college tutor to like check that it was all legit and that I wasn't just some like idiot. And there was some sort of higher authority was sort of vaguely watching over what was going to happen, you know,
right?
Because I didn't know what I was doing, but I just thought it just seemed so exciting to do it. And so that was the first gig I put on: Lungfish, Circus Lupus, Dead Wrong, and Hecatomb, a Preston like death metal band.
Well, that's just going to change things from that point onwards, I guess, like for up until now. You know, forevermore.
Yeah, massive. Yeah, it was huge. Yeah. It was just like total game changer and like life changer. Just seeing these bands that you love and they've come to your hometown, which, you know, isn't really great for live music. Me and my friends who organized it, we all kind of pooled in and the two bands that, you know, that were on tour, Circus Loopers and Lungfish, ended up staying at each of our parents' houses. So we just kind of dished two or three people to like someone else's house and a few people to my house. So we really sort of engaged with, you know, these people who for us were like fucking amazing sort of superheroes who played in bands and, you know, from America, and they'd come to Preston, and it was just like, I probably barely said a word to them because I was just too shy and just kind of like, fucking hell, this is crazy, you know, but just really enthusiastic. And it was just amazing that we pulled it off and made it happen. And like loads of people came as well. And I think it was, you know, one of the best or at least well attended gigs on their tour. So they were really happy with it. And also like probably quite intrigued by a bunch of teenagers and staying at their parents' houses as well.
Yeah. Well, I did a similar similar thing with Braid and Ghetto Kids. When they first came over, it was like, I did it as part of a project when I was doing my A-levels for design studies. And, you know, you get this, you're like hyped up because there's some bands, you know, they come around the house and like my mom made the like pasta for them and stuff. And they were really grateful because they didn't get fed. But like we didn't, I don't know. It's being a kid, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't really get it until you're kind of in that position yourself.
And you realize it's shit.
you realize that. Yeah, you need to eat and you need somewhere to sleep, you know. Yeah. You need the map with directions on it and basics like that. You don't really get it until you're sort of on the other end. Like a few of them had stayed at my mum's house, and then that was like the meet point for everyone the next day before they headed off to a gig in Leeds. So like they came to my mum's house and did laundry and stuff, and just, you know, they were just hanging around. And I had my drum kit set up and the little practice amp. And yeah, Asa from Lungfish, he was just like, hey, Neil, do you want a jam? Do you want a jam, man? And like, all right. Yeah. So he plugged in, he got his guitar from the van and plugged in. And yeah, the guitarist from Circus Loopers grabbed a guitar and an amp and joined in as well. So we just had this like mellow little jam in like the back room of my mum's house. And Daniel Higgs was sat at the kitchen table, like just clicking his fingers. And, you know, it was fucking great. I loved it. But then it was going quite well. But then the guitarist in Circus Loopers started playing something in like 5/4. And at that time, I was just like completely bamboozled. So I was just like tripping over the riff. And I was just like, oh, what's going on? Why can't I get into this? You know? But then I think he figured it out and then just sort of, you know, came back to a more manageable time signature. But yeah, that was just like such an amazing thing for me to do that.
Right. So I guess this inspires you to follow things to Leeds then. I mean, what was the decision and when approximately was this move? I guess, how did you know that there was a more of a something happening or something, other people you could play with?
It was my mate Rob. He was like my best mate, and he had a car. So at that age, we'd already been going to gigs in and around like the north. So we'd been to the gigs in Manchester and also Wigan as well. Wigan had a like a happening sort of DIY scene, and also Leeds for gigs at the Duchess of York. So I just became aware of Leeds because, like, you know, bands that I was into were playing at the Duchess, and we'd go over to watch them, and a lot of Discord bands actually. So I saw loads of fucking great bands of that time, really memorable shit. The times that I had been over to Leeds, I'd sort of clocked that it looked like a really good place to skateboard as well, just really for those two reasons, music and skateboarding.
Yeah.
And I finished my college course, and I didn't know what the hell to do. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no direction, like, in that sense. But I knew I just didn't want to go and get a shit job. I somehow managed to find a degree course in Leeds, a librarianship degree, which would accept me with my sort of mediocre results. So that was it. You know, that was just my ticket, and I was out of Preston. Yeah, I didn't go in halls of residence or go that usual student route. And actually, it was when student grants were still in existence, so I was eligible for one of those. So I just kind of moved. Didn't have to take a loan. and had no real stake in that learning environment. So I ended up living in a house with a random guy. I'd looked at a few places, and this guy, I saw that he was into like Big Black and things like that. So I thought, okay, that'll do, you know, at least there's some kind of music connection. And the house had a cellar as well. And my sort of aim or goal was like to live somewhere with a cellar that you could set up into like a band practice room.
Yeah.
So that was it. And essentially, you know, like the academic side of it was really just a sort of like ticket. And I think I lasted maybe 6 weeks, 2 months as a student. I didn't last very long. I'm the first person in my family to go to university, but I only really went to university for about 6 weeks. From that point, it was all about music, you know, just like full on. And while I lived at that house, the cellar became the practice room for both Baby Harp Seal and Polaris. Both bands started simultaneously around the same time, and that's where we sort of started playing. And practicing, and the guy I lived with, he was cool with it. He was like, he didn't really give a shit about like a load of idiots making a noise in the cellar, so it was all good.
Yeah. So this is like mid-90s.
That was the end of 93.
Right. Both Baby Harp Seal and Polaris are formed with you as the drummer at the same time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I knew Rob Holden, the guitarist in Baby Harp Seal. I knew him from Preston because he's from Garstang, which is just down the road. So I'd met him at gigs.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'd met him at gigs and maybe even skateboarding as well. So we weren't in touch with each other, but we must have just bumped into each other in Leeds, you know, and sort of re-established a connection. Rob knew the other guys who were in Harp Seal, who ended up being in Harp Seal as well. So he kind of brought that together. I remember him sort of like testing me out in a way. It's just like, because I said, yeah, I can play drums. And it's just like, he didn't really believe me. He wanted to like come in my cellar and I had to sort of almost audition for him.
Okay.
But then I just played a load of, I don't know, I tried to play like a no means no beat or something. And just
right.
Like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But Polaris was like, the route for that was a bit different because those guys weren't necessarily into the sort of whole DIY world. They were kind of coming from more like a kind of indie rock sort of side of things. I met the guitarist through skateboarding actually, and I knew I wanted to do like a Slint sort of band, so he was really into that. And I think through him we kind of got the other guys kind of got involved, Andy and Johnny. So that was all like late 93. And it was amazing, really, just turning up without knowing anyone in a city that I had the vaguest of connections with. But it just seemed so easy to, you know, just go out on your skateboard and make new friends and find out a bunch of them played instruments and they were into really great music. I don't know. I don't know if you can still do that, you know, but it just like seemed to be, you know, there was no fucking plan or aim. It was just kind of like just happened, just really really happened super easy with no effort whatsoever, just sort of, I guess, just going about your business doing what you were doing, and like it just all fell into place. I suppose having a house with a cellar was key to it,
and
that's key to a lot of the whole Leeds six, like the Leeds six postal area where a lot of this stuff was happening. The fact that houses had cellars was really key to it because it meant that bands didn't have to bother moving their gear around or like renting a space or going to like a practice room.
So is this where the first shows or the first sort of public performances for both bands, that's where they happened, was in like cellar shows?
For Polaris, yeah, we played in somebody's cellar at a party. I think we only had like three songs, but it was just an excuse to actually do it in front of people. The first real gig for Polaris was actually in Preston at the Caribbean Club. And the first Baby Harp Seal gig was in a pub, actually, in a function room. So it was like upstairs in the Royal Park pub. But I remember them both amazingly well because, you know, I played in bands at school and I played in a band at college. but I hadn't played a gig for like a couple of years. So that first Harpsichord gig, I remember just being like quite terrified and sort of like really, really sort of like nervous about the whole thing. Like my leg was shaking. You know, I remember my leg was shaking, the hi-hat was wobbling. But it was amazing, you know, I sort of got such a buzz out of it afterwards. It was great. And same with the Polaris gig as well. That was, you know, just fun, just fucking really fun just to play in somebody's cellar and people are just like right there, right next to you, you know, feeling the wind off the bass drum against their legs.
This is like 94, 95 when both bands really happen with regard to recording and I guess being more known in the UK.
Yeah, both bands didn't waste any time really in terms of recording. Polaris recorded six songs that we thought, you know, we thought of it as our demo. That was like, you know, bands recorded demos. Not that we sent it to anyone, but yeah, we did that. We recorded six songs in a studio. And Harpsichord did something around the same time as well. I think we recorded four songs around the same time. Yeah. One of the guitarists in the second guitarist, Tom Chapman in Harpsichord at the time, he knew Ian from Subjugation Records. That just fell into place really easy. You know, he just said, oh yeah, I'll do a 7-inch. So we just went into a studio and just like blasted out four songs and that became 7-inch. And I think a leftover song was used, or was it two songs? I can't remember. But anyway, yeah, Polaris and Harpsichord ended up doing a split 7-inch. And that split 7-inch was using a recording from, you know, each of their respective first times in the studio. And from there, yeah, I guess it was, you know, it all just became part of that really underground DIY circuit of that network of people just putting on gigs and, you know, and then sort of returning the favor with other bands in other cities in the UK. We also kind of made connections with a band in from Potsdam in Germany around the same time. And that was through meeting a German student in Leeds who then brought his friends over, and we all just became a big kind of gang. And they ended up coming over and playing gigs in the UK, and then they organized gigs for us in Germany as well. So that kind of broadened the whole network out, and that kind of led to both bands being able to then tour Europe around the same time. So I think, yeah, Baby Harpsichord and Keto did a tour in Europe in 94, and then we did it again in 95.
So then I'm wondering, Polaris continues, but Baby Harpsichord, you're not on the album, are you? Or you don't drum on the album?
No, I played it. I played from the start to up till the end of the second tour in 95. And during that time, we put out maybe 4 7-inches. So I played on all the 7-inches. Me and Rob fell out on the last tour, on the 95 tour. I quit. And I was done with it, you know. I just thought, well, there's no kind of like limits on my opportunity to just like make another band or a different dynamic and sort of like easier on a personal level. That was it for me, for Harpsichord. And it's sad, you know, it definitely was sad because it was like, it finished like in a just with a weird vibe. But thankfully, it didn't last long. You know, we made up and it was no big deal. There's no kind of like lasting grudge or anything. Yeah. And actually, it was nice because, a mutual friend of us all, Chris Johnson, he took over my place in Harpsichord. It meant, you know, I could go and watch them, which is a strange experience, watching a band he used to be in play live. But it was nice. Chris was a really good drummer as well, so it was really cool that he was taking over, and you know, and I could kind of learn stuff from him that I didn't know how to do. So it was cool. But I got to play with them one last time, which was a nice way to tie it all up. They had a gig at the 1 in 12 club in Bradford, and that would have been either like late 95 or early 96. I'd been out of the band for a few months, but I was at the gig and just going down to watch them. But Chris didn't turn up. Chris could be flaky, and this was one of his flaky moments, and he just didn't show up, you know. He was just like, where's Chris? Don't know. Where is he? Don't know. And it, you know, it's getting closer and closer to when they had to go on stage and there's no sign of him. So it became more and more apparent that, like, I was going to do it, you know, I was just going to get up, having not played with them for months, and just sort of wing it. And that's what happened. And it was really good, actually. I still knew how to play the song, so it was fine. And it was just, yeah, it was a good feeling. It was a good way to sort of draw a line under, like, you know, my tenure in the band. And yeah, and it kind of made up for how it ended previously with sort of bad feelings. And it, you know, sort of, it ended up with warm feelings. And
is this when Bilge Pump comes into play then, or were you playing, or when did that band start?
Yeah, Bilge Pump started in, I think they started in about 1993. Joe and Emlyn were working with a drum machine and did a couple of albums. I became aware of them. Well, I became aware of both of them when I first moved to Leeds in late 93, because I went to a gig around the corner and this band Zoopsia were playing, which was Emmeline's band. Emmeline was playing bass and singing in that band. And they were sort of like heavy kind of, I don't know, like God Machine and that kind of stuff. And they were, you know, really brilliant. And also Joe was playing in another band at the time as well. I think he was playing in Mask that night. So I got to see him, and he was on drums actually at the time. So that was my first sort of, the first time I'd seen Joe. A little bit after that, I saw Bilge Pump playing in the same place, maybe like 6 months, a year later or something. So then Joe was playing guitar, Emlyn was doing bass and singing, and they had a drum machine. Yeah, it wasn't until at least 95 when I ended up living in the same house as Joe that I became a member of Bilge Pump. So it was either late 95 or early 96. And I think I just asked to join. I was just like, can I be a drummer? You know, I've seen that you're struggling playing along to this drum machine. So that came, yeah. So Bilge Pump came into the mix. It would have been after I'd left Heart Seal. Solanke, this other band I played in, Solanke, began during that time. That band began, would have begun in 95.
Is this just like a product of having the free time and the ability to jam and just be like, oh, we're going to do basically a Minutemen covers band?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. 100%. We just, at that time, we'd moved house, but we had another house with a cellar and a practice room. And yeah, exactly. Everything was just set up. We just had a practice room in the house, so we could just play. And it was in a student neighborhood, so we didn't really have to worry about bothering anyone, you know, or like, didn't seem like a real neighborhood with people who enjoyed peace and quiet.
Well, it's not like that offensive either, really, is it, the music? You know, it's not like screaming and loads of distortion,
I guess, but I wonder if you can still get away with it. I got to a point where there's no way I'd want to live next door to a house with a fucking band in the cellar, you know, like playing really fucking loud. That's not my idea of, like, a good neighbor.
Well, the areas change, don't they? I mean, I'm sure it there's just not a way it could happen now where it just wouldn't, would it? I mean, yeah, areas change, get gentrified and things, and
yeah, I don't know what Leeds is like now for that, on that score, but I suppose if you're still really in an area where nobody really gives a shit about noise, then probably get away with it.
Did you see Solanke, you were playing with like fucking German hardcore, it was like Sistral or something, I think, some ridiculous like bill. It was just like you guys, and it was on a hard, total hardcore bill.
Great. Was that the Broken Doll gig in Newcastle?
Yeah. I mean, Flat Earth like puts out the Solanke 10-inch as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. We found a home with Sned.
Yeah.
Forever grateful. I was so surprised when he said he wanted to put out a recording, just because it didn't seem like a, I don't know, because that band, the whole approach was to just do it, not spend any time like changing songs or agonizing over songs, just writing them playing them, figuring them out, turning them out really quick with no, absolutely no sort of like going over them and changing them, polishing or anything, you know, which was the approach of other bands that we were all in at the time. So I was just dead surprised that like, you know, somebody wanted to like commit it to vinyl. But I'm so grateful for it because it's one of, I don't know, like Mark, who recorded it, has just totally captured it, you know, totally just got it down. And we just whipped through the songs and that was it. It was done.
So was that's kind of like a long standing relationship as well, isn't it? With recording with Mark Sims, who had been playing bass in Bob Tilton at that point as well. So the whole kind of set of people, I suppose.
Yeah, Mark moved to Leeds. So he became the, you know, and started getting into recording. So it was just like an instant fit that he would offer to record bands. And again, it was just all done in like houses that we lived in. All these different elements of what it takes to make a record were pretty much just in-house, with varying degrees of like quality, but I mean, it just didn't matter. I mean, nobody was worried that it wasn't, you know, an immaculate recording. Making do with what you got was basically the attitude.
Yeah,
it's pretty humble. It was like pretty humble setup. I think with some of the more complex music in other bands that were around and that I was in, it probably would have benefited to have a more sophisticated setup. But like for Solanke, because it was just straight ahead, really direct, just like three piece, it just works, you know, no overdubs, no nothing. It just kind of caught the essence of the band really well.
Bilge Pump, how does the recording differ, or does it, how greatly does it differ, you know, at that point? Because you I guess you're recording, just throwing things up, but then you're kind of, I'm guessing, spending a bit more time with certain things.
We did the first Bilge Pump album in the same place, in the same cellar that we did the Solanke recording. It was the same process. We maybe took more time over it. I think it was probably spread out over more days, but it was really just the same deal. The bass, drums and guitar were all recorded live, and then the singing was put on later. But I don't know, by then I think Mark had probably expanded his gear, because it was a few years later. It was like at least 4 years, possibly 5 years after we'd done the Solanke thing. So I'm sure Mark Sims was like way more focused and finessed in what he was doing by then. My head was not into that techie side of it at all. You know, the audio side of it was just like another world. I could just only really pay attention to what I was doing.
Yeah. So like the later 90s, I remember it is Diesel Versus Steam and Wooden Spoon, the two bands that like they're pretty of the time, you know, 97, 98.
Yeah.
And I don't know much about like the how those projects or groups, they came about, or what was different about them all. Because from what I thought, it was just like, I didn't realize, I don't think that every band I saw from, or I thought that every band that I saw from Leeds was a different drummer, but it kind of wasn't. It was you really who was drumming in like 99% of the groups, you know, which I guess gives it like a theme, definitely, if there's one person always in a band and the constant, and you're the constant, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there were always the same people in, you know, it was a sort of rotating cast really of the same people in different formations. But yeah, more often than not, I was a drummer. Although Wooden Spoon, I was a singer. So for a brief moment in time, I was at the front. There were other drummers, but I suppose they were in their bands. And there just seemed to be a willingness to sort of like just make bands and make, you know, even if you're in two already, it seemed to be no issue to like begin a third or a fourth as well. And I suppose each one sort of reflected a different like attitude or approach or influence in terms of what you were doing. So yeah, kind of all different sort of spokes on the same wheel in a way, because the you know, often the same people were in the same bands.
So it's Diesel versus Steam, who was in this group?
That was Seth, who was playing trumpet in Diesel versus Steam, and Seth had played bass in Baby Harpseal and Solanke. It was Andrew Rain, who joined Baby Harpseal after Tom Chapman left. And it was Mark Sims, who played in Bob Tilton, and he was doing all the recording at the time. Yeah, me on drums. So it was just another variation of like this sort of same characters. That was a band that, like, I guess it had a bit more of a definite approach as to what it wanted to do. It was instrumental. There were a few songs that had singing, but I don't think Andrew liked singing very much, so he never really did it. So we ended up just being essentially an instrumental band.
It didn't really last too long anyway, did it? There were just kind of things that happened for a moment and then...
Yeah, exactly. It lasted maybe 2 or 3 years. We recorded 4 songs and I wanted to put out a 7-inch or something because I hadn't done that before. And it's just like, these are all the things that you could do in this scene. You know, you could make a band, you could do gigs, you could go on tour. You could put records out, you could make a zine. I wanted to like tick off putting a record out, but Seth moved to London and that pretty much like it was, you know, the nail in the coffin for the band really. And we just sort of wound it down. But we did manage to go around Europe and tour and play out and about quite a bit in the UK as well. Thing I didn't mention actually when we were talking about house gigs was the second house I lived in Leeds, where the one that Solanke started in. We were there for a year. It was a shared house, like six people. You know, we had the practice room in the cellar, and it joined. It went through this archway. Built. It was knocked through, so there was like the practice room in the cellar, and it was an archway, and it was through into this big kitchen. When our tenancies were up after a year, our kind of parting shot was to organize a three-day festival in our house. There were three bands on each night for, like, you know, over a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
Which is so ridiculous to think of now, the fact that all this was happening in a sort of, in a terraced house in an urban neighborhood. But it was the place where, like I mentioned, the back of the house ran into an alleyway, which was just kind of like, you know, a dirt track. So there's all this kind of, all this space for people to hang out and have a bonfire and stand around drinking. And that kind of tied in with like 120 Rats was a squat in Leeds where the Headache Lot lived and put on gigs.
Yeah, we played there one time. I remember that, yeah.
I remember that actually, because I mentioned to Joe in Objections that I was going to talk to you. And he remembers Oran de Forest, and he remembers that gig at 120 Rats as well.
We got like emptied the place. They hated us. Like, we got a note. I remember Rob, he wished he still had got the note, because it's basically saying, due to the audience's reaction and ours, could you like cut your set short? You know, we were just these like horrible little cunts and that. We didn't even, for the bass, so that at the point in time, we didn't have a bass player. So we were just like, we'll just bring a bass, plug it in and put it up against the amp, and that'll be it. You know, it'll just like, that's the bass player. And then just made horrible racket with the other stuff, and just that room was full.
Yeah.
And then I remember there was only about like a handful of people left at the end. I remember Paul Rauschen was one of them, because he likes to say that. but that was that, yeah. Because I remember going there and watched, they were like, we went up to whatever setup they had upstairs. It was like a little portable like TV, and they were watching like the Manowar video or something. And we were just like, what the fuck? We're just not part of this thing at all, you know?
That's kind of, that's the legendary sort of like performance. It's amazing how polite the note was, you know? It seems very very formal and polite. But Joe remembered that actually.
Yeah.
Because it's Ratus who was the sound man who.
Yeah.
Who
handed that's the guy. Yeah.
But that was my first introduction to squats as well, going to 120 Rats, because that was happening like when I moved to Leeds in late '93. So didn't take long to end up there, because they opened as a bar and then they put gigs on as well. So, you know, people just gravitated towards it because it was like, it was fucking great. It was exciting, you know, for a few years while it was happening. Oh, it's nice to like get the lowdown on the note.
It's one of those things, you know, if you could like trade everything you've got, kind of, you know, not like, you know, you could just say, oh, I'll give you fucking here's some possessions I've had, you know, just to get this one fragment of like something you would do it, you know.
That'd be a beautiful thing if that note turned up.